Welcome back, guys, to A11 Crypto again. And today we have the pleasure of welcoming Renick Pelle, who is the CIO and founder of Stratos Technologies, to talk about venture investing as it relates to both crypto and non-crypto startups. As you guys probably know, I am a fan of many aspects of traditional VC investment approach. But before we dive into details today, why don't we first address the elephant in the room? What a day today. The Coinbase news, a bunch of all-time highs, and the recent US regulatory proposal that coming out. Yeah, Renick, how do you feel about these things?
Yeah, you know, like I said, when we first started the call, it's a great day for crypto, DeFi, blockchain. You know, I think there's been a lot of anticipation around the Coinbase IPO. I think it's kind of interesting that Coinbase decided to IPO. We could talk about that, but I think the bigger news, honestly, is the regulatory news. But also great to see that Coinbase has IPO'd at an all-time high for both ETH and Bitcoin. Yeah. I think could not be better timed for their IPO, for sure. And I wonder how much of the coin price is a reflection of that. Who knows? Probably somewhat, but all good things nonetheless.
Yeah, monumentous, I think. No idea what price gonna do, but I think as an industry, as a market, as a validation of the, you know, the ideas in the space, this is huge. So Renick, you have a long history in the investment world, right? So maybe why don't we start with your own journey in investments and crypto?
Sure. Yeah, I think that makes sense. So I started my career in New York, working for a fund called Sanders Capital, which is a $40 billion global equity fund run by Lou Sanders. So he was formerly the CEO and chairman of AllianceBernstein and one of the first guys at Sanford Bernstein, which is now known as Bernstein Research. And for people in the hedge fund and, you know, Wall Street traditional stock investing community, is known as really the preeminent research firm. And so I learned to invest through Lou, and he taught me really, you know, how to think about businesses, companies, macro environments, and how to think about research, most importantly. And so there was a very strong culture of intensive fundamental research at Sanders that had carried over from Bernstein. And, you know, one thing that I should mention, before I was in investing, I was actually trained in applied math, mechanical engineering, and then ultimately quantitative finance at MIT. And so, you know, I came into the investing world with the view that, you know, I was hoping that there'd be some technology that you could use to help make investment decisions.
Right.
Based on my experiences, you know, someone who was more focused on math and physics and engineering, and, you know, came to realize that wasn't possible, but, you know, still maintain like a pretty strong interest in technology and, you know, how that might influence things. My last real in-depth research project at Sanders before I left and started Stratos was on blockchain and Ethereum. And so at the time, we had multi-billion dollar positions in the large global banks, both in the US and international. And if you guys recall, like in the last, you know, in 2015, that was sort of one of the first hype cycles around blockchain. Mm-hmm. And it hit Wall Street, and people were kind of thinking like, what's going to happen to traditional banks if blockchain technologies really, you know, disrupt the need for a database, a centralized database for transactions? And so my research was to try and figure out whether or not that might, you know, threaten our positions in the banks. And so I went and spoke to the chief technology officers of those banks. You know, I specifically remember a conversation with Barclays around it. And at the time, they had created a blockchain accelerator program to really look into, as a way to show to Wall Street that they were on top of things and to to try and basically say, look, we're developing our own technology to maintain our position competitively in, you know, transactions. Because Barclays is one of the big, money center banks that does a lot of correspondent banking internationally. And so, you know, the idea of blockchain and Bitcoin specifically seemed to be very threatening to that business. Anyway, I concluded that they weren't really doing anything interesting. No one really knew exactly what blockchain was at the time at the banks. Sure. at the time, there was an argument that, well, all you really need is just a private or public database. It's just a matter of implementing the existing technology. So that didn't really result in anything particularly insightful. Other than that, Ethereum and the Ethereum virtual machine, what it promised was going to really change the world, but it was going to take some time to get there. So when I started Stratos, we were always focused on fintech, and we were investing both in the equity and credit, so cross capital structure of fintech businesses. But we had always kind of thought about how can we implement blockchain technology into what we're doing. And so there was an idea early on when we started the firm that we could somehow use smart contracts to help manage the structure of our funds and our investments. And, you know, at the time that technology didn't exist, so we weren't able to do it, but we kept a pretty close eye on the development in the space. So along the way, made some investments in companies. The most successful is Compound. So we were in the seed stage of Compound. This is out of the holding company. We didn't have a fund dedicated to crypto at the time. But, you know, came across Compound and looked at it and thought, okay, if Ethereum and blockchain technologies are going to create a new financial ecosystem, which we had the strong view that it would, mm-hmm. then you need to create a term structure of rates. And in order to create that, you need to have the short end first. You need to have basically overnight lending and borrowing rates. And when I met Robert, who's the founder of Compound, and he basically laid out that vision and how it would work and what the mechanics for that was, and, you know, the automated liquidation and over collateralization, all the kind of key components of the protocol, it definitely felt like a bet worth making because it fit within our investment framework. So fast forward to summer of 2020, DeFi summer, everything started launching, Compound included, and like these capabilities came into view.
Right.
That's really when we decided now is the time for us to get very active in investing in DeFi directly, because it really marked an inflection point between more speculative investing and investing in things that really generate economic value. You know, if you look at the biggest protocols, they're generating revenue. They're actually cash flow generative as opposed to making a bet on the value of ETH or Bitcoin, which, you know, we've done. We just haven't done it with other people's money. It's not really what we know how to do as investors.
Sure. So like, one of the things you touched on that really got my attention was that you mentioned Barclays was doing this blockchain accelerator back in 2015 to, mm-hmm. I guess that's more like a PR thing, to show that we are here, you know, with the forefront of the technologies. But do you think they get it? For example, do you think they understand what Compound Aave is doing in the DeFi system?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. So at the time, I got the sense that it was a PR thing. When we tried to dig into what was actually going on there. But do they understand it today? I think there are people at the bank that probably do. Are there people who can really do something about it at the bank who understand it? I don't know. Mm. But my sense is that most of the press around crypto is still focused on Bitcoin. Mm. And, you know, if you look at Coinbase, I mean, you know, it's a perfect example. Today's a great day to be talking about this. Most of the focus is on Coinbase and it being a trading platform. And, you know, a lot of the discussion around crypto still centers around, you know, sort of the common mm-hmm. Issues that people see in Bitcoin. So, you know, to the extent that people are familiar with crypto and blockchain, it tends to be Bitcoin. And so I think most of the existing Wall Street world is not that familiar with DeFi.
Sure, sure. I mean, it sort of makes sense, right? Like, from their point of view, there has to be this gateway into the whole, you know, it's quite a complex system, and Bitcoin is that gateway for them, right? It's like, you know, I think when even if they do want to come into the DeFi world, the infrastructure may not be ready for that yet, right? Both regulatory speaking, as well as, let's say, technology-wise or liquidity-wise. Maybe it is more ready than before, right? But BTC is still the biggest market. It's the first mover. It is the, you know, single shedding point, you know, store of value. People are still wrapping their head around that. And then slowly but surely, right? You know, people are getting to this idea of smart contract. Instead of having legal contract, you have in code. And, you know, it's sort of like this idea where, you know, you start it off with the moneyness of money, and then you go into with the financial instrument, and then you go into maybe intellectual properties, and then you go into like data. It's like this transition, propagation of, you know, crossing the chasm, right? Like what do you cross first, right? That sort of thing. But like, I like that you did equity sort of research first, right? What are the some sort of similarities and differences between, let's say, equity research and your process of looking at crypto, right? Do you do you know, thesis driven investment, or you're more opportunistic?
Yeah, that's a great question. So on the surface level, investing in publicly traded stock or a venture capital investment versus crypto and protocols and chains, et cetera, they seem very different because the fundamental economics are different. You know, the way you get exposure to these different things are different. The way you actually transact in them are different. On a deeper level, the research is all the same, which is this question of where are we on the technological frontier? What is being created that maybe wasn't possible recently? And this is true even in public markets, by the way. If you're really doing, especially tech research, you have to have a sense for why is now the time that this thing is going to work? Why is now the time for this company to really expand if it's public and already exists, or if it's a new early stage equity investment, why is it the time for this business to be started? And will it be successful? One. And two is, what is their competitive dynamic? Like, why is this business position to be the best at what it intends to do? What are its moats? What kind of network effect does it have, if any? Those questions are still the critical questions in my opinion, any type of investment, whether it's a publicly traded stock, a early stage company, or a protocol. And I think, you know, the way in which you seek out those questions are different depending on the stage of the company. You know, a publicly traded company is much more about, well, how can I observe customer dynamics to that would imply to me that this company has some sort of competitive advantage. But for an early stage equity investment, it would be, who are the founders and why are they the best at doing this? And how are they going to be able to create this sort of advantage? And then in protocols, it's a little bit of a blend of the two, which makes it so interesting to me from just an intellectual perspective, which is, who are the founders? Who is the team? Who are the investors who have formed around it that are going to help create the network effect that is kind of inherent in every protocol? But then also, how is this protocol positioning itself in terms of its feature set and capabilities on the technological frontier, where it's providing something that's unique, that doesn't exist in the market yet, but also has some staying power, isn't just going to be forked or improved upon by the next version too easily?
That's some really good question there, right? It's I think that dives into the center of VC investing. You know, you keep mentioning, who are the founders? Why are they the right people to do this, right? What makes this particular venture going to be successful at this particular time, right? So how do you address these questions, right? I mean, do you have a bigger macro framework that you refer back to get an answer? Or how do you see this?
Yeah, so I think there's kind of the overall investment framework that we have in the DeFi and crypto space. And then there's the sort of tactical project by project evaluation that we make. So there's two levels of that. So from the more top-down investment thesis view, we have a vision about how the crypto world is going to evolve over the next few years. And it's, if you look at the history of crypto, you can see that there are some very distinct moments where there were technological developments that enabled spurts of growth, new functionality. Mm-hmm. And we expect that there will be a similar future to that. And that dynamic, that sort of cause and effect dynamic, is going to continue. So what were those originally? So originally it was having just crypto, fiat to crypto on and off ramps, Coinbase being one of them, Binance being one of, you know, the best known sort of internationally. And so giving people some way of easily getting into crypto, mm-hmm. like this was, you know, 2015 mm-hmm. level stuff. Before that, it was much more challenging to get even to buy crypto. You know, you had to be much more tech savvy, even though I would say you have to be relatively tech savvy today to do it. So then you had the development of stablecoins, which is something that, you know, is, I think, seems somewhat trivial to someone coming into DeFi now, but before that existed, there was no way to keep your money in crypto without basically explicitly making a bet on what was going to happen to ETH or BTC in dollar terms. Right. So like, if I wanted to say, okay, I want to continue to operate within crypto, even though there wasn't really that much to do other than speculating at the time.
Yeah.
You had to take this sort of extremely volatile risk. When stablecoins came about, and I mean that primarily USDT, USDC, mm-hmm. It enabled you to keep your liquidity in crypto, in DeFi, and benefit from a lot of the, you know, great aspects of crypto without actually taking that risk. And so then that enabled the development of a huge boom in features in DeFi. And I think that was one thing that really precipitated what we saw in crypto summer of 2020.
Right.
Okay. So what are the next things now that are going to unlock the future of crypto? Well, the next thing is scaling solutions. So right now, obviously, the cost of transacting in the Ethereum network is just too high to really enable things other than fairly large financial transactions. I mean, you're talking about a few hundred dollars just to send money around.
Right, yeah.
So that obviously doesn't scale. And so the scaling solutions that are being worked on, you know, there's layer zero, Polkadot, layer two, rollups, all of the parachains being built on Polkadot. That, in my opinion, is the most interesting investment space today, because I see that as the infrastructure of the future. It's kind of like investing in the cell towers of 5G, essentially. And except for the fact that they have no physical limits to scale, which is like a very important comment to make. So like if you buy you could buy the most valuable cell tower, probably some 5G space in lower Manhattan, but it only works for lower Manhattan. And, you know, having a really valuable parachain in Polkadot is like having a cell tower that can reach anyone on Earth. So like, that's a pretty powerful insight right there, but that's really more of an investment related insight than it is about, you know, where the technological frontier is going to go. So I'll continue on that point, which is once you have scaling solutions, then you enable micropayments. Once you have micropayments, because now your gas fees or whatever fees exist in the particular network you're talking about are significantly lower. So it suddenly makes micropayments viable. Mm-hmm. When micropayments are viable, then you suddenly get into this moment where you think, why do you need a Visa, MasterCard payments network? right? If you can send micropayments around the world at a reasonable cost directly on the blockchain, why do you need those things? And, you know, you could see it based on, you know, Visa's strategic decision to start using USDC. They see that. That's why they're doing that. But then what happens when you have micropayments, then everyone on Earth, particularly in emerging markets, have an interest in holding wallets on their phones.
Yeah.
And then holding crypto. And so then once you have that, what's the next thing that you need? You need identity. So when you have identity and you can start to understand, you know, what is a distinct wallet holder? What has their behavior on the chain been historically? How do I start to think about credit underwriting and that sort of thing?
Right.
Then you start to create like a fully fledged international financial network. And then the last piece is importing human judgment into DeFi. So today, everything that DeFi is great at is essentially computational, things that computers can do.
Right.
But there's no way to, in a decentralized way, bring judgment into DeFi, right? Like, who's making decisions? The way that decisions are made today in DeFi is through decentralized governance, right? But if you want to start making loans or doing other things that are effectively judgment calls at the end of the day, how do you do that in a decentralized, trustless way? And so the project that I'm a founding team member of, it's called Goldfinch Finance, is working on this. This is something that we're pretty focused on. I can't speak to too much detail on how exactly we're going about it because there are some things that we haven't announced publicly yet, but I think that's really where things ultimately go. And if you start to imagine what happens in the world when you have a decentralized, trustless source of human judgment that's incentivized in a way to get people to, you know, make the best possible decisions they can on behalf of the protocol, you start to get to a really interesting future state. And it's not that far away.
It's interesting to hear your thoughts on the macro environment, how it will play out, especially the importance of scaling solution. I think a lot of times in crypto, without having a taking a step back and looking at things more broadly, we think only about gas fees, right? That's what scaling solution is for. But actually, it enables a lot more than that, right? If you have the gas much less costly, much cheaper, then, you know, a lot of things will be enabled. And one of the things you mentioned is that micropayments. And, you know, that what came to my mind was that, you know, I think one of the things that stablecoin and maybe the DeFi Lego has enabled is this idea of risk tranching and being able to hedge your risk, right? Before, you were just speculating on the things. Now you can hedge it, right? And that would, I think, when there are more people getting into the worldwide blockchain system through whatever layer ones there will be, you know, then if there's, they also get education about what they can do, you know, things that you mentioned about the project that, you know, you are working with, Goldfinch, would become a stable dApp, right? That offer tons of functionalities for these people. And suddenly the participation of this whole ecosystem is totally on a different level, right? But if we compare this to what we have today in traditional, I guess, finance world, right? It really is a gated community, right? Currently in traditional finance, right? I mean, I remember the first episode I ever did on this podcast show is explaining what Wi-Fi was, why Wyrm was, right? Try to go to your bank and ask for a percentage of the loans, the profit they make, right? You try to buy a CDS, good luck. So yeah, I'm super excited about the future. So if that is your overall theme, right? How do you look at a project specifically, right? So how do you do things tactically? And also maybe give people a better idea of, you know, what sort of ticket size you guys normally do, and, you know, what sort of projects that really interest you.
Sure. So to answer the question, well, I want to say one thing that you alluded to a second ago that I think is really worth mentioning, which is to your point about banks giving some portion of their profit to their users. You can't own a portion of banks' profits by going out and, you know, buying the shares. But you're exactly right. There's this dynamic between the customer and the business that is inherently at odds. You know, the business wants to earn as much as it can from the customer, and the customer wants to pay as little as it can. Hmm. And if you think about what's going on in DeFi, it's actually inverting that dynamic in a way, where actually the incentives of the protocol and the incentives of the user are aligned,
right,
which is a really important thing. And it actually changes the incentives of all the actors in the space to move from something that is rent seeking to something that is network building. And so I think that speaks to why we're seeing the development occur so quickly, because people are inherently incentivized to be collaborative and pull in the same direction, as opposed to being sort of interested in maintaining their own fiefdom and seeking rent. Mm. So I think what you said is very insightful there. So to answer your question about what we look for and how we invest in it. So we see a lot of projects. So, you know, there are projects that come along that are interesting to us that maybe don't fit directly in the investment thesis that I described, but we try to find a way how they will really help act as a stepping stone to get to these sort of major ideas that I laid out. So some of them are directly on the mark, like identity solutions. Some of them help create a functionality that's needed between here and there. So we keep an open mind in terms of how various projects will fit into our overall framework, but seeing how the future unfolds and what needs to happen to get there, I think is very important for us to stay focused on where we think things are going. Because our interest here is being infrastructure investors in what's going to be developed and what is being developed, as opposed to sort of being sidetracked by things that are, you know, interesting, but maybe actually don't take things in the direction that are actually going to be really transformative for the financial ecosystem and, you know, just value transfer overall. And I see DeFi and crypto as bigger than just the financial ecosystem, as you can tell, you know, just NFTs and things like that. It's really expanding beyond that. In terms of what kind of things do we invest in and how, so we'll start at pre-seed. I'm an advisor to the Berkeley Blockchain Accelerator. We see things really early on. So we'll start from pre-seed. We'll go to even as late as post-token launch if we see something where we can be value added by, let's say, buying a token and restaking. We're even in talks with being vault providers, early vault providers to some projects that don't have the ability to launch a governance token, which is something that we could talk about, like how that works and why. But we're structured in a way to be as flexible as possible in terms of how we participate in the ecosystem. So we have a traditional venture equity fund, but it's mostly fintech focused. Our DeFi fund is an evergreen structure that enables us to both invest in early stage equity pre-token launch, you know, typically with the expectation that there'll be a token at some point, but also do other things. So if you look at the capital that a project needs, the vast majority of it is not in the form of early stage equity. It's the form of staking and liquidity and other sort of structures and collateral and things like that. And so being structured in a way where we can pick and choose how we want to participate and find a way that's going to be the most value added and differentiating for us as we invest in projects and really listen to what the team and founders need is how we've designed the fund. And so we have a couple of staking investments. We have a couple of early stage equity investments and, you know, things, a blend of the two. You know, if there's an opportunity to do early stage, we'll do that. And we'll also potentially come in and increase our exposure through time through staking or liquidity investment as well.
Yeah, makes sense. I think the market has evolved so much that a lot of value add these days involves around, like you said, staking. Whether that's especially if you're in DeFi, you know, your protocol probably needs some sort of liquidity or some sort of active governance participation, right? And that staking is key to bootstrap the system. But one thing I really want to drill into is that, you know, in crypto, we rarely have a, you know, anything like a Series B, Series C, right? It's like one shot, right? It's mm-hmm. people raise one round, token goes, you know, becomes liquid at with a unlock schedule. And whereas in traditional fintech, you have rounds after rounds. The key thing for me I want to get an idea of is that what does experience tell you about the pros and cons of, you know, crypto projects do not have a further rounds? Or do you think that would change as the market gets more sophisticated?
Yeah, well, there's a lot wrapped up in what you're asking. And I think there are a couple of things at play there. So the first is, why aren't there later stages? Well, there are two reasons. One is that you can launch a governance token and move towards decentralization fairly quickly. And as a result of that, there's not really a need to stay private. Because everything in DeFi is inherently liquid, why would you stay private when you could launch, become decentralized, and, you know, create these inherent network effects by launching a token, creating incentives, as opposed to just staying private? I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing is the amount of equity capital needed is just much smaller on a per project basis. You know, if I look at what we've been able to build at Goldfinch with a relatively small team compared to a traditional fintech, it's remarkable. And, you know, that's partially because the team is great at what they do, but it's also partially because of the inherently open source nature of crypto. So you don't need to go and ask people permission to do things. You don't need special access. Everything is open and permissionless. And since everything is code-based, it's really just limited by how quickly you can build an engineer, as opposed to, you know, in traditional finance, waiting for permission to do things, waiting to get, you know, approvals, agreements in place, et cetera. And so that's another reason, you just need less capital. And so the way in which these projects raise it is different. Now, your question about where's the future going is an interesting one, because, you know, on the surface, I would say my view, and this is the reason why we structured the fund in the way that we did, is as regulation catches up to where we are, projects will be incentivized to launch tokens sooner, not later. So even the need for early stage equity will be less. I don't see it necessarily going away fully, unless, you know, grants and foundations become even larger checks at the early stages of these companies. You know, like the Web3 Foundation, for example, is particularly prolific when it comes to getting early projects started and providing grant money. But, you know, you still have the engineers, the team, they still need to get paid a salary. And today that's comes in the form of fiat, although, you know, most investors in the space provide capital in the form of USDC. It's essentially the same thing, right? So until that goes away, or people start using crypto, you know, in a more native way, and maybe that happens sooner than we think, there will still be equity, early stage equity rounds. But beyond that, you know, as long as regulation catches up, why wouldn't a project launch a token early and create those network effects? I think the counterpoint to that would be, does there emerge some need for a strategy to stay, quote unquote, private, you know, pre-token launch longer to build some infrastructure? Maybe if it's a particularly technologically complex project, where, you know, you're creating a new consensus mechanism or something like that, or you're seeding a new network. But even then, I would argue that a project is better off incentivizing the actors around it with a token than it is staying private and raising traditional venture. But we'll see how things unfold.
It's super interesting what you said there. I mean, the reason I asked that question comes from the angle where in traditional VC investing, you know, future rounds is a validation of the milestone you've hit, right? And then your valuation will be reflective of that. Now, in crypto, you know, I don't know what to call it. Maybe reflexivity, right? Seems to be supercharged, right? Like,
yeah.
There's no, you know, venture rounds, for better or worse, have, you know, valuation ranges, right? Whereas in crypto, you can raise at, I don't know, whatever, 50 million. And by the time you launch, you're at 500. And that's like, you know, within 2-3 months. What are some of your thoughts on that? Because, you know, the token and the price maybe, is that a function simply because of the current market or the unsophisticated, well, yet to be mature market nature? Or how do you see that point?
Yeah, so that's a great question and something that we're doing a lot of work on with our data scientists on the team. But, you know, I think it's helpful to take a step back for a second and ask, why don't private traditional fintech companies go public sooner? Why don't they have a liquid price that's being determined by the market? It's primarily for regulatory reasons. And historically, companies did go public earlier in their life cycle when the regulations of being a public company weren't so severe, but also before the venture capital market developed in the way that it did. And the reason why the venture capital market and in particular growth equity, private equity developed is really from a desire from large institutional investors to invest in asset classes that had no volatility, which is a really important point. And I think it's a little bit off topic, but I think comparing DeFi, which has some aspects of it that are really unique to it, where the traditional constraints of the existing financial infrastructure doesn't exist, you know, you have to reconsider why things are the way that they are in the traditional financial ecosystem first before wondering why it isn't that way in DeFi, if that makes sense. So to answer your question about valuations, I think that in some senses, the valuation is being set by a marginal buyer of a governance token that is irrational. So someone who's, you know, the YOLO degen, so to speak, about, you know, okay, I'm just going to go and buy this token. And there's no analysis around what the effective price earnings ratio is, the market cap to TVL, you know, whatever ratio you think is relevant that's reflective of some fundamental value. That's not being taken into account. On the other hand, we found, surprisingly, that there are some projects that seem to be valued rationally relative to their revenue. Mm. And one thing that's worth mentioning is that every project that generates revenue, that revenue, assuming that it flows to the governance token, is actually the same thing as earnings in a publicly traded company sense. So, you know, understanding what the right multiple should be on what those effective earnings are is an interesting research analysis we're undertaking. But it really flows into the comment you made first, which is there's reflexivity here. And I think that's the perfect word. And it's one actually that I've used on a podcast prior to this to talk about the same idea, which is that once you have a token that launches and you have a way to incentivize the activity of investors or stakers or users, you create this inherent reflexivity where as you participate in the growth of the project, the tokens that you're earning for participating increase in value and so on and so forth. And you get this sort of dynamic where every protocol has a network effect. And every protocol also, to go back to the statement I made before about the, you know, the worldwide 5G cell tower, every project is massively scalable. There's actually no limit to scale. Everyone on Earth can use, you know, 1-inch or Uniswap or Dodo, right? And so from that perspective, the potential to create tremendous value, even from a rational perspective, is huge very early on in the project's lifecycle, which is a pretty remarkable, you know, investment-related insight as well. Right. Now, I'm not saying that you can pay anything for these projects. I'm not saying that. But I do think that it's worth mentioning that, you know, some of these properties, so, which they basically are, you can use the real estate analogy here, are extremely valuable and have a lot of staying power. And in that vein, they do create a lot of value very quickly.
Yeah. I think you made some very good, fair points, especially the one, you know, about we should ask questions about why other things they are in the traditional finance before thinking about why things aren't that way in DeFi or crypto. So let's go into a bit more of the way you qualify a project, a startup, right? What is your, I guess, you know, investment process, right? What are some important criteria you look for in a team and founders? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's a perfect segue, actually, because your point about, well, let's consider traditional finance and what the constraints were that existed in traditional finance that maybe are no longer relevant in DeFi is kind of this phrase we use at investment committee at Stratos, which is it DeFi enough when we look at a project? Which is to say, like, okay, if you were to translate what exists in the traditional finance world into DeFi, you might say, oh yeah, we need X, Y, and Z type functionality. But if you take a step back and say, do we actually need it to look like X, Y, and Z functionality? Or is that just replicating an existing constraint from the old financial ecosystem that doesn't need to exist anymore? So like one thing that I think is very interesting is the idea of continuous derivatives, continuous hedging instruments. Right. If you have everything that is inherently liquid, do you need there to be a maturity on the instrument? Or can it just be continuously tradable and continuously representing some exposure to an underlying financial payoff? We'll see. You know, that's certainly something that we look to when we are looking at, for example, you know, derivatives, exchanges, options, exchanges, et cetera. You know, there's a lot of innovation happening there right now in the space. And so it's just one of the discussion points we have and something that we look to. You know, I think the best example of that is an AMM. You know, some of the most valuable projects in DeFi are AMMs. And the automated market maker concept is something that doesn't exist in traditional finance. And it can't exist in traditional finance for a variety of reasons, but one of them, and the central idea is that you have this, in an AMM, you have a bonding curve that allows liquidity providers to have no knowledge of the market that they're providing liquidity to. The bonding curve does the computation for you. In traditional finance, to be a market maker, you have to have that bonding curve in your head. Or you could write your own algorithm, right? Most market makers in traditional finance, they are algorithmic. But still, you know, that is a proprietary algorithm that you're using as a market maker. And, you know, Uniswap, the other AMMs, they provide that publicly. And so what does that do? Well, on the one hand, if you were an AMM, or you could create the equivalent of an AMM in traditional finance, you'd never want to share that because your trading returns would get arbitrary.
Right.
But the reason why you don't want to share that is because there's no way for you to benefit from the growth in that use. But with Uniswap, because you have a governance token that your liquidity providers are earning in exchange, you're creating this network that benefits when everyone uses it. So it kind of ties in what we were saying earlier about how the incentives change. And so we really try and use that analogy as often as possible when we're looking at a project to say, okay, if it fits in our framework in terms of where the technology is going, and fits, you know, on the technological frontier in terms of what's possible, then the question is, okay, well, what is unique about this for DeFi, and does it really fit into sort of the zeitgeist of the space, or is this just replicating blindly what already exists in traditional finance that actually doesn't need to exist in DeFi?
That's some really good food for thought. It's very I like it. It's very, I think. What's the word here? I'm not hearing a lot of people thinking about things like that. Especially thinking about, you know, most people would think, okay, I need to replicate what's already working. You know, from traditional finance to DeFi, but you're asking the question, well, is that even necessary? If there's no constraint, what does that look like? And if that fits into my investment thesis, I'll leave people to ponder on this question, right? Because I think this is a very, very interesting angle. I really want to sort of like get into the way maybe you assess the team, right? The founders, right? Because that seems to me very central to your investment process. Yeah. So tell us about maybe the qualities and how do you filter for these qualities in founder team?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's obviously, you know, where the rubber really meets the road. You know, all the other ideas that we're talking about here are, you know, they're checking the box on them. The question is, can they really execute? And, you know, I think it benefits that we've interacted with founders in traditional finance, or fintech rather, quite a lot. And we started to identify and have a pretty good pattern matching for the founders that are successful, and the ones who really think about what it means to be in the financial industry and build certain things the right way. So one of them is, you know, being intellectually honest and really understanding what they're building and what they're doing and having some unique insight about how to do it. But also being willing to have an honest conversation instead of trying to make it seem as if they have an answer for everything, because no one has an answer for everything, especially when you're starting something new, especially in frontier tech. And, you know, I'm a founder myself, and, you know, I'm not the founder of a single fund. You know, we have 3 funds. We're a larger organization. You know, we do things in a way, obviously we're focused on investing, but we also are thinking about things from a business and operating perspective. And so I have experience with that. And then, you know, working with Goldfinch, watching those guys and watching them execute at what I think is an extremely high level, and kind of taking all that together to create that pattern matching system. And I think those are the key things. You know, how well does a founder know what they're talking about? But also on the flip side of that, how intellectually honest and open are they to having a conversation around what the challenges are going to be? And then being willing to take input. But then on top of that, sort of the table stakes are, what has this person done in their career already? Like, what have they been able to execute on that shows that they have the ability to do what they're saying they're going to do? And so I think the other thing is, and there's this term, I think this is a Mark Andreessen term about I heard him talking about it, but this idea of a prepared mind, which is, if you've done enough of your research ahead of time before you're talking to a founder to really understand what they're going after and trying to do, you can understand how deeply they understand their own project, and then, you know, how thoughtful and sort of unique their approach is, the granularity with which they understand the challenge that they're up against. And I think we, you know, as a very research focused organization, try to be in that position when we talk to projects.
I just want to highlight to people who may not come from a, you know, research driven background that this is actually extremely difficult to do. I mean, just researching about projects, you know, if you go to a project in crypto, I think a lot of people would just go to a website, look at the headlines, right? This is a lending platform. Oh, that's it, right? It's a lending platform. But to actually understand the context around that, right? The competition, the operational challenges, the technology challenges, and you know, what who do they need to make the system work as partners? And who do they not have currently but need to get, right? And how do they get there? All of these things, I think, requires immense thoughts and time and experience. It's very difficult to do in a vacuum, I think. I don't know what's your experience, but that's my experience so far.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you know, one of the things that needs to change in DeFi is that projects are going to have to provide more transparent information publicly because these things are liquid. And I think, you know, that's really where regulation is pushing. And I think we should talk about that today. But yeah, the research is non-trivial for sure. You have to talk to the team to really understand what's going on. You also have to read the white papers, but you have to put the two together to really understand where they are, what their aspirations are, you know, how they're being motivated, how they think about the development of the project, because you don't really see that externally. The other thing that's a major initiative for us is data science. And, you know, we are very data driven at Sanders and have been at Stratos. But one thing that's unique about crypto and DeFi is that all of the data that is relevant for making investment decisions, which isn't to say that we're only data driven. You know, there's a lot of qualitative data that we take into account as well, you know, like we were just talking about when it comes to the founders. But all of that quantitative data is available. It's publicly observable on the chains. And so having a strong data science initiative and capability to understand what's actually happening for a project, you know, what is the unique wallet activity? You know, what is the usage level? All of that, it's really interesting because that tells you a lot. And when I was doing public equity research, you'd almost always find that when you're looking at a company, there were a couple of data points or a time series of data that you would have really wanted to know to help cement your conviction in a view on that company. And what would inevitably occur is that you'd realize that that data is not publicly available. The company is not going to give it to you. There's no expert that you can speak to who knows it. And, you know, if there is someone in the world who's collecting it and has that data set, they're not going to give it to you. So you'd have to come up with some other way of ascertaining what that data would have looked like. And ultimately, if you could have gotten that data, that would have been extremely valuable. And so, you know, today, obviously, as I said, crypto prices are not really being set by rational investors, but ultimately they will. And I think having this data set and rigorous internal process for doing so is going to be a big advantage for us and will be a helpful value add to our projects as well, because we can say, hey, we've seen this, or this is what's going on. And, you know, we're looking at this cross chain and, you know, this is relevant information to you, you should be aware of.
Right, right. I think this is super interesting to bring context, contextual knowledge that the project itself may not have, especially, mm-hmm. you know, if somebody is thinking about building something cross chain, you know, how much activity is there really on, let's say, someone like, I don't know, Tron, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed mm-hmm. to what's out in the media. But, you know, one of the things I think you can shed light on for us is, you know, in the space, I think a lot of times what happens is that the investment rounds are happening earlier and earlier, right? And mm-hmm. obviously, I think for people, for founders who already had exits before, it's much easier for you to judge whether these guys will be executors, right? Mm-hmm. But for people maybe who haven't done that before, you know, how do you judge maybe the ability of founders to execute, to put the ideas into reality if they are early and you know, there isn't really any product for you to look at?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, when I say observing the founders' history and what they've done in their career, it's not only, you know, looking for successful ex-founders. Obviously, you know, that is helpful in identifying, you know, who's going to be able to succeed again. But at the same time, you know, that's not deterministic either. Being a successful ex-founder, you know, the nature of being a founder is that you are the right person at the time and place to make that business work. That doesn't necessarily guarantee that you're going to be the right person in that time to make the next business work, particularly in something like crypto. That being said, there is a lot of reflexivity around the name and involvement of successful founders, so that helps. But, you know, it's the same thing. It's what has this person been able to achieve that they set out to achieve in their life? And is there some reason to believe that they're going to be able to succeed at what they're setting out to do now? as well as, you know, how clearly and honestly are they looking at their project roadmap? Like, are they being unrealistic? Are they realistic about the challenges? You know, and one thing that we really like about our investment strategy is we can invest in the same company multiple times and in multiple ways. And so if we invest early, you know, that might be a way for us to get involved and observe that founder's execution and then, you know, potentially double down or provide liquidity or stake later or both. So, you know, it's not necessarily one swing at bat for us in terms of making our investment.
Yeah, I think that helps you de-risk your process, right? It's like maybe you can write a smaller check to begin with and as things progress, you double down or triple down. I guess let's talk about maybe some of the successful and notable investments you guys have made and you know maybe what are some of the milestones that people can look forward to in these portfolio companies in this year.
So I think, you know, talking to Compound, the reason why I'm talking about this one in particular is you know, it's pretty public, so I think the things that I can talk about here are, you know, not going to get in trouble for talking about them. But one of the things that I think is so interesting about Compound is like they're executing on becoming a platform in a really compelling way. And when I say platform, I mean like every day we talk to a new project that's somehow linking to Compound. And they're basically helping to solidify Compound's dominance in the space and really create the money market. Like, the money market thesis, they are executing to a T, and they're doing it in a way that has such a brilliant long-term vision. It's really awesome to watch. And, you know, one of the ways that they're doing that is by creating this cross-chain strategy, kind of like a meta-chain structure. And, you know, that to me is a really interesting data point in our overall scaling solution research, which is, you know, how does a project pick any one scaling solution to work with? Or how does it become compatible with multiple? Okay, well, you know, there are a lot of EVM compatible Polkadot parachains and things like that that help solve that problem. But you still create this issue for a project that needs a large pool of liquidity, which is that your liquidity is sort of stuck in each one of those ecosystems. And so if you're Compound and there are huge economies of scale where the more liquidity you have, the better the rates are, you don't want your liquidity to be stuck in different places. You want it to aggregate into one place. And I think their solution about this cross-chain thing is super interesting. But it also leads us to the view that that is not something that is sustainable. Not every project is going to be able to do that. It will be sustainable for Compound, but Compound has enormous resources now because of their value, you know, the value of the tokens they have in treasury. So it's just not viable for most other projects to do that. So we're looking for projects that solve that problem for, you know, sort of the next wave of protocols. And we view that as one of the key pieces of future infrastructure, but, you know, kind of like a middleware layer between protocols and the underlying chains. Instead of each protocol having to do the legwork today of trying to understand which project or which chain or scaling solution it wants to be designed around. That's, you know, something that I think is a very interesting research process for us. And I think we're at a really interesting inflection point in the technological development of blockchain overall, in that, you know, we're in this transition phase between, you know, Ethereum dominance to the multi-chain world and how that's all going to play out. And I think this is one of the key pieces there. It's kind of like when you're on your phone and you dial a number, you don't have to pick which
carrier,
cell tower, or network you're going through. There's middleware that does that for you, and that's going to be built, I think, in the blockchain world as well. But it's really interesting to watch Compound strategy around that today as kind of a first mover.
How do they actually do it? Remind us.
I can't really speak to that.
Oh, right.
Really,
okay.
Like tight-lipped on it, but, you know, there'll be a public announcement.
Okay. Everyone, read up and research and watch out for the announcement.
Yeah. And speaking of announcements, so Goldfinch is going to announce a seed round here soon. I can't really say much more than that, but we're really excited about who's involved and who the lead is. And you know, Stratos is getting involved in a significant way as well. So that is a very exciting thing for us. And you know, I think, as I said, Goldfinch is really a pioneering project in that, you know, the goal of Goldfinch is to be a decentralized global bank. And the way we're starting is by making loans to real world borrowers.
Right.
So the pool on the DeFi side is uncollateralized in the sense that you provide your capital and you earn yield on it and you receive a derivative token, you know, that you can trade and gives you liquidity. But on the borrower side in the real world, it is collateralized by real world assets,
right,
which is unique. No one's done that yet. There are a couple of projects that are maybe looked at doing similar things, but that's every project that we see that is doing something that bridges DeFi into the real world gets me really excited because that's what has to happen next. You know, there's obviously a huge amount of value has been created by building tools that are, you know, endogenous to DeFi. It's you know, speculating tools and hedging and things for, you know, playing within the DeFi sandbox. There's nothing wrong with that. But if DeFi is really going to define, you know, the future of finance and is going to create this generational shift in the way that people interact with technology, it has to bridge into the real world. And so like Goldfinch and some of the other projects we're looking at right now, you know, there will be, I think, some really interesting things to happen as a result of that, as well as, you know, the human judgment part of it.
Right. So to summarize, two things to look out for, people. One is Compound, the cross-chain announcement, and Goldfinch seed round announcement. I think you're giving us a lot of teasers, right? Maybe we need to get you back another time to go through these things. So I'm conscious of the time right now. So why don't we wrap this up by having you answer two fun questions, right? So who is an investor that you respect, crypto or non-crypto? What is the interesting book you have read, crypto or non-crypto?
Yeah, so the two investors that I think have made the biggest impact on my life, I'm also very fortunate to know personally.
Mm-hmm.
So the first is Lou Sanders, who trained me how to invest and was my first boss when I worked for him at Sanders Capital. And, you know, he is just incredibly smart, knowledgeable about so many things and so disciplined as an investor. That is really a key characteristic. But beyond him being smart and, you know, extremely articulate and thoughtful, but like very disciplined in the way that he goes about making investment decisions. And that was a great way for me to learn how to invest. The other is Charlie Munger, who I've been very fortunate to also spend a lot of time with, who's been kind of a mentor to me in the past. And he, you know, if you know who he is, he's the vice chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, kind of, you know, is just one of the most interesting thinkers that I've ever encountered in that he has such a unique way of thinking about everything in life, especially the really important stuff. And, you know, he is kind of a different, has his own unique style as an investor, but he's a super high conviction investor. And he's one of those, you know, I think he holds three investment positions today with his multiple billions of dollars. That's super rare. And, you know, I took a lot from that, from, you know, his investment strategy and what I've learned from him in terms of being a high conviction investor. And, you know, that's kind of an uncommon thing. And, you know, sometimes in venture, you don't necessarily want to do quite the same thing, but, you know, there's a saying, you know, there are diminishing returns to needing to be right often, right? So
yeah,
what that means is it's really hard to be right often. And if you could be right and just really right once, you'd rather do that than make 100 bets.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why you make 100 bets is because you don't know which one's going to be right. But if you feel really good about being right, it's better to be convicted and take a high concentration bet. And he did that with Berkshire. You know, a lot of Berkshire's investments look like that. His personal account holding Costco, you know, it's been a super high conviction bet because he's smart enough to really understand what businesses and features create the sort of like unfair advantage that's going to continue to enable it to really compound over time. And as an investor, that's one thing that I really look for. And that's one thing, frankly, that's gotten us so interested in DeFi and crypto, because I'm basically seeing all these cell towers with zero marginal cost and zero limits of scale being built right before our eyes that are going to define the future of the internet. Like, why would we not be interested in investing in that across, you know, all the other things that we have the opportunity to invest in? So that's kind of a, you know, technologically forward version of the Charlie mentality. But he's been a big influence on me as well. And then in terms of books, you know, to speak to the tech thing, I recently read The Rational Optimist, which was a book that was actually recommended to me via podcast by Naval, which is a really awesome book because it basically lays out a history of how, you know, the name Rational Optimist comes from the fact that humans should be rational about the future being better than the past. And it's almost entirely driven by technological advancement. Yeah. Every technological advancement is what has created the improvement in the quality of human life. And, you know, when you look at that and you have that perspective, you start to see things in life that are unfolding on a technological side that really will do that. And I think, you know, a great example of what we've seen in the last year is the, you know, how quickly the COVID vaccine was developed and now being rolled out. You know, you can talk about how it should have been faster or should have been rolled out more quickly, or there were mistakes, and, you know, humans make mistakes, especially when we're doing things for the first time around. But it's remarkable that we were able to develop that so quickly, and we're kind of moving on and thinking about what life's going to be like post-COVID. Mm. If this were 30 years ago, and it easily could have happened 30 years ago, right? It could be a decade before that's developed, or if, you know, or longer. And so I think I try and find things in life that look like that. And, you know, Rational Optimist is a great way of looking at the data and a lot of more historical data points to support that view. And yeah, hopefully DeFi and crypto is another one of those that we see in our lifetimes.
Oh man, like so much golden nuggets there. I totally feel you. I have so many questions, man, regarding, you know, cell phone towers, regarding unfair advantages, how to create that, and about a lot of things you said. But we got to get you back. I think that's the conclusion right now. So Renick, thank you so much
for.
Yeah, let's do it. I think you should be like a feature guest, like more regularly. I love this conversation.
Yeah, let's talk about regulation next time.
Oh, but, let's do that.
Great to chat. Thanks for the time. Look forward to doing it again.
Thank you so much.